Warning, this podcast details firsthand accounts of graphic crime, as well as deeply disturbing emotional profiles, and may not be suitable for all listeners. Please proceed with caution.
Molasses Manifesto.
That was also in the Forest Hills, Queens, about 50 feet past the last one. Would be about 5 weeks later.
What were the casualties here?
One woman was killed. She wasn't sitting in a car, she was walking home, and I just shot her.
A Molasses Manifesto production brought to you by Audio Up. You're listening to Killer Tape, the true crime podcast where killers and hardcore criminals tell their own story in their own words. I'm your host, documentary filmmaker Bill Badgley. Joining me is veteran prison reporter Jack Jones. This is Killer Tape, Season 1, David Berkowitz, a.k.a. the Son of Sam.
I hope you die.
He confessed to being the 44 killer, ordered by a voice speaking through a neighbor's dog to carry out his bloody outrages against young pretty women.
I snuck up on him and shot him.
Berkowitz planned to use the revolver again and again until he felt police were getting close.
I wanted to help people. I wanted to be important to somebody, you understand?
David Berkowitz, 24 years old, found himself surrounded by police. Well, he said, you got me.
And now the need for a story, if not for anybody else, for myself.
Police say those words ended the biggest manhunt in New York City history.
I should spend my whole life here for what I've done.
Episode 13, Local Hero, David Berkowitz. Act 1, Going Postal.
Let's go back over and film the notes. You did two crimes while you were working for the cab company.
Right.
Two more while you were with the sheet metal company.
Yeah.
And the rest was the post office.
In March of 1977, David Berkowitz was just past the midway point in the string of vicious attacks that would come to define him, and the second half of these attacks were carried out while he was working at the post office.
At some point in his job searches, David Berkowitz had taken and passed the civil service exam to work for the U.S. Postal Service.
On the exam, he received a score of 80.5, which the Bronx postmaster later said was, quote, a high mark for someone with Berkowitz's limited education, end quote. After attending his first union meeting, it was said by someone in attendance that after the meeting, David walked out into the parking lot, opened the trunk of his car, and began selling all the tools he had used at his sheet metal apprentice job for heavily discounted prices. David Berkowitz was moving on from the factory life. Quote, he simply walked away from that job during the union meeting. He walked away and he never came back, end quote. And so it was that David began working at the Bronx General Post Office on Grand Concourse, scanning postcodes from 4 in the afternoon to just after midnight for $13,000 a year.
It was, according to him, a well-paying job, the best-paying job that he'd had. A lot of benefits. He worked night shift, and according to the people he worked with, there was no reason to suspect that he was mentally defective or a bad person in any way, according to his coworkers.
Of course, this was nothing new. There was, as there always had been, a lot going on inside David Berkowitz that other people never quite seemed to pick up on. Jack asked David if he carried the 44 with him to work.
Did you carry the gun with you when you were driving back and forth to work?
Well, yeah, but it stayed in the car. Because sometimes after work, I'd go right out to these neighborhoods.
When the workday was over and it was time to relax, where most people might head to the gym, grab a bite to eat, or go to the bar, Berkowitz got in his car and went out looking for someone to harm. Almost as if punching the time clock signaled a deep, significant, and in this case, deadly, change within him.
He's a regular guy. He's punching a time clock, collecting his paycheck, and going home. And when the urge hits, getting in his car and engaging in his preferred recreation, which is either saving people from from danger or murdering them.
Jack asked David what he typically did the day after one of his attacks.
After you get home after the crime, you'd always get a little work,
Yeah, if I had work to go to, I'd get up and go to work like nothing ever happened.
The day after an attack, David would get up and go to work. Everyone around him blissfully unaware of how he had spent the previous evening. Quote, I would walk into work at the post office one day after a shooting. I would see the faces of confusion and fear. Then I would say, what happened? Gee, that's too bad. I hope they catch the bastard. End quote. So at night, David Berkowitz scoured the city streets looking for someone to harm. But during the day, he was just another mild-mannered civil servant who no one really paid much attention to. And if they did, sometimes found him downright cordial. Quote, it's interesting to note my changes in behavior and actions during the daylight hours and at sunset. They were two opposites. At night, I hunted. In the day, I helped. I became vicious and lethal at night to people I never met before and whom I just met by chance. On the other hand, during the day, I was kind, friendly, and courteous to other motorists and pedestrians, also neighbors and strangers. However, these two extremes I cannot explain. David goes further to say, quote, even if I behaved during the day, I still had evil thoughts, end quote. A coworker seemed to agree, saying, quote,
there was nothing wrong with him. He showed no disturbance, didn't even blink an eye when I mentioned the .44 caliber killer, just like any other person. He is the last person I would suspect. He was always courteous. If we had to lift anything heavy, he helped us. He was a gentleman, opened the door for you, and he was never vulgar. He talked like the rest of us, mostly about work and how difficult the job was.
You were considered a very courteous person by the people who knew you.
Yeah.
We did the post office and that sort of thing.
He was known as a punctual and responsible employee, pretty much like he was known during his military time. And that's what the whole thing that police struggled with and that we struggle with as normal human beings, I think, trying to grasp how somebody could go out with the purpose of hunting human beings, shooting them anonymously in the head while they sat in cars and go have something to eat, go home, clean up, go to work the next morning without any feelings of guilt or remorse or anything but a sense of relief of having done something, however vile.
Quote, people think I'm honest, but I'm not. I have an innocent face, but I'm not at all innocent. I must admit I do love my face. I mean, I can fool anybody with it. It's above suspicion, so to speak. My face, my lips, and my blue eyes are like weapons which I sometimes use to my advantage. I was very aware of its usefulness during my crime spree, end quote. Even though no one expected him, still, the whole city was talking about the murders, and this included his coworkers.
One thing that might have tipped off a savvy person when he worked at the post office is when one or more of his co-workers described the Son of Sam as having to be crazy, and he became defensive about that, knowing that he was the one committing the murders and thinking of himself as perfectly sane. Not only perfectly sane, but a person who was driving around also looking to be a civic hero.
Jack asked David if he ever overheard people around him discussing the attacks once they became public.
What about when you were at work with people there?
Oh, all the time, yeah.
What were some of the comments?
That the guy was a madman, deranged madman.
How did you feel?
Well, I tried to point out that he wasn't deranged.
You did?
Yeah.
How did you try to point that out?
I said, look at the way the guy is doing the crimes. He's too clever. He's not crazy. He may be crazy in a sense, but not insane or anything, you know.
David made it a point to mention that not only was the individual behind the murders not crazy, but beyond that, he was quite clever, according to him. And he did it while standing right next to women, not very dissimilar to those he was viciously targeting. Jack asked David how he felt about the women he worked with.
What about the women that you work with at the post office? How did you think of them?
They were nice, decent.
Older, younger?
My age.
Did you ever date them?
No, we had no social life, really. I liked this one girl there. We got along real good.
Did you ever ask her out?
No.
He's working very closely with women, and including some who would fit the profile of the women he would later be stalking after he finished his shift at the post office. He was on affable terms with them, never asked them out for a date or anything, although some were described as attractive, intelligent co-workers. And several times these women would ask him if they would walk with them to their car after their shift ended, because they were afraid they might become a victim of him, not knowing that him was the Son of Sam.
When the Son of Sam was on the loose in New York City, women there would ask you to walk them when they went to their cars.
Yeah.
That must have struck you as a pretty ironic sort of thing.
It did, but I was smart enough not to tell anybody about it, you see. Yeah. This shows you again, just going back, how sane I really was, despite everybody saying that I wasn't, because you see how I was able to cover my tracks, you know what I mean? That demonstrates sanity as opposed to insanity, you see what I'm saying? But it was ironic, yeah.
On at least one occasion, David Berkowitz walked a young lady to her car after their shift let out in the middle of the night in order to protect her from him. This coworker would later say, quote,
"We got off at 12:30 a.m. My friend was parked on a deserted street a few blocks away. We were glad to have someone walking with us to the car. We were afraid of going there because of the Son of Sam. He was parked on the opposite side of the street. He waited for us to start our car, and we waited for him to start his, and then we left. When I saw his face in the newspaper, I didn't want to believe it was him. I was shocked. I couldn't believe it."
Jack asked David how he felt walking these women to their car.
What about when they would ask you to walk them to their car because they were frightened because the Son of Sam was making his forays? Did you never showed any sort of sign of being startled or?
No, because I never would have harmed them, because I knew them. I could never reduce them to objects, because I already saw them as human beings. I worked with them, sat around, talked about our problems with each other, you know, and drank coffee with them, took our lunch breaks together, and real good relationship with them, you know, to a degree. So I could never have harmed them.
Just as he had after helping the three teenagers get their car out of the snow, David maintained that he could not harm his female coworkers due to the fact that he identified them as people. People he spoke to every day.
What kind of problems did you talk about?
Well, for me, it was just like mainly financial or something, you know, problems with my car. I never got too personal, you know, discuss personal problems.
And how long were you there?
Oh, yeah, it was about 6 months, I think, 6 to 8 months.
Was there any time that after you had walked them to their cars, that you went back and got the gun, or you had the gun with you and you went out for some crimes?
Yeah, but it was not because of them, you know. I would have done that anyhow. I just did them a favor, and it only took 10 minutes more to walk them to their cars, you know, or something. It never really occurred to me that they could have been harmed, because I never would have harmed them, you know.
He was simply David Berkowitz, the nice, helpful coworker. There was never any thought that he would harm these women who he knew by their first names. But it would have been the same thing if he was shopping and met a woman in the supermarket. "Sure, I'll walk you to your car, even though it's late, and ideally, you're my target profile." He wanted to be known as a nice, helpful guy.
And all the while, no one seemed to have any idea, seemingly due to his unremarkable presence, which seemed to give him more than just a little pleasure.
You weren't the kind of person people would suspect of doing that sort of thing.
Yeah.
You feel like, aha, I'm putting another one over on the stupid bastards, or...
Yeah, I should admit that.
He'd taken satisfaction in being this chameleon sort of character who could make anyone think he was not capable of malice or violence since he was a child. So he took a great deal of private pleasure in not being suspected.
Not being suspected was a great skill of his.
When he was in his work frame of mind, he was David Berkowitz, the all-around normal good guy, mainly. And we usually do what we do for recreation and the things that give us a diversion. We usually do those on our days off or on weekends or whatever. And that's what these murders were to him. They were his way of calming the chaos and turmoil inside his mind and dealing with the rage he felt toward people who played their televisions too loud all night and people who wouldn't control their barking animals in the neighborhood.
David Berkowitz set out to kill in order to relieve the pressure constantly building in his own mind. And he did it in a very cold and calculating sort of way. Each time he left the house, he knew exactly what he intended to do. Not that he always found the perfect situation. David's psychiatrist would later say, quote, despite all my crimes, he told me, quote, I failed to find a suitable victim 99% of the time, end quote.
Well, I know this is very cold, you know, a cold-blooded thing, you know, a way to describe it. But I knew what I was going to do, like, before I left the apartment that evening. You know what I mean? Some nights I wasn't successful, so I just went home.
You mean you couldn't find anybody that you felt safe?
Right, yeah.
Jack asked David how many crimes occurred after work when he was out driving around with the 44.
How many of the crimes occurred after you got off work?
I don't think any crime occurred after I got off work. Most were on the weekends when I was already off. The first four crimes happened when I wasn't in the post office. The fifth crime happened on the day I was off from the post office, which was Tuesday. When I first started working there, I had Monday and Tuesdays off. The fifth crime happened on March 8th, you see.
And this one happened much earlier in the evening than the others.
There came a point where victims were harder to find for mainly because people were staying off of the streets after dark because of him. So he had to broaden his search area. He talked about being frustrated on the nights when he was looking for someone and he couldn't find a target. He wanted to make sure he had an ideal setup where that he could do the shooting and turn and flee immediately without any risk of encountering someone else on his escape path.
Act 2. An accident looking for a place to happen.
One of the more astonishing aspects of this whole tragic, astonishing story is that at the same time David Berkowitz was cruising New York City dark streets looking for people to shoot in the head, he also was traveling with a trunk full of emergency equipment ready to leap like a self-anointed superhero to the defense of beleaguered citizens.
And he was doing it for a specific reason. Ever since David Berkowitz's adoptive mother Pearl died in 1967, David had harbored inside himself a deep desire to die a hero's death. He still wanted to die, as he always had, but now he wanted to die with honor, a hero. Trouble with that was, in order to die a hero, you have to be a hero. And as it turns out, he actually did put some work into becoming one. I mean, more work than he ever had for just about anything else. Anything else besides mischief, murder, and mayhem, that is. David Berkowitz, always eager to help.
He was a strange combination of sort of a couch potato action junkie, wannabe, driving around with emergency equipment, including flashing lights to reroute traffic. That there's an accident that he came upon. I mean, this guy was prepared. In one sense, he was the ultimate Boy Scout. And in the other, he was this predatory monster looking for innocent, hapless victims.
There's one auto accident I remember on the Bruckner Expressway, and that would be by about Crosby Avenue. You wouldn't know what that is, but there was an accident. A guy and a middle-aged couple involved in an accident. The woman was in the car, but she said she couldn't move, you know. I comforted her, and she was very grateful.
After coming upon what sounds like a fairly heinous car wreck, David held an injured woman in his arms and comforted her. And for that, he gave himself quite a bit of credit.
99% of the people just drove by and continued on their way. I pulled my car off to the shoulder of the road and, you know, got out all my emergency equipment, you know, the reflectors. In fact, that's interesting because I had, in my car, I had so much emergency equipment, it was unbelievable. I couldn't wait to use it all, you know, but I never had the chance. I had all these reflectors that I made, and they were excellent. The guy asked me where I can get one of them, and I told him I made it.
David Berkowitz had his own homemade emergency equipment, and he kept it in the trunk of his car just in case he needed it.
He wasn't just ordinary off-the-shelf kind of emergency first responder in his own mind. He didn't make a lot of money. He worked low-paying jobs. The only evidence of any sort of craftsmanship or creative ingenuity that I recall him talking about was designing emergency equipment and going to the junkyard and taking flashing lights off trucks and buying these inexpensive flashers and attaching them. Making your own emergency equipment to save lives while you're out looking for people to kill. The juxtaposition just boggles the mind.
He just wanted to be loved. Either that or he was going to kill somebody.
I wanted to be needed by somebody. If there was a fire up the street with a building in flames and the people were trapped in there, I'd be the first one to run in there to help them, you know. Yet the meantime, I was only walking through the neighborhood to look for somebody to hurt, you see.
His big thing, of course, since childhood had been fire, and he was always on the lookout for fires. Occasionally would stop and pull an alarm box to send in a false alarm here and there, get a little action. Park and watch while the truck showed up in the confusion and then go on looking for somebody to kill.
Like the volunteer fireman that goes out to set fires himself and then runs to the calls, you know, with the... Yeah, you know what I mean? Like, you're not so much to stir something up, but the idea to feel important, to be needed for something. And then if you wait for the circumstance, it may never come. Sometimes you find, like, in that case, a guy would have to create his own. You know what I mean? You know, people don't realize, well, it's not important for them to realize whether they do or not, but, like, if I'm telling you that in that neighborhood, if there would have been, as I was walking around for somebody to harm or kill, if a fire had broken out down the street with people trapped inside the building, I would have been more grateful for that incident, you understand, my chance to help somebody than to go out and hurt somebody. You know, I was just simply like, you know, I would have been overjoyed at the opportunity to come to somebody's aid and save their lives and take somebody's life.
The whole thing was his way of being in control. If he couldn't do it in a positive way, by rescuing people from burning buildings, he was going to do it in the most cowardly way possible, by shooting people from behind wherever possible and sneaking up and murdering people for no reason.
But this is the irony of the thing, and I wanted desperately, you know, not to do the crimes. I wanted to help people. I wanted to be important to somebody, you understand? But these people never seemed to need me for anything. I'd have much rather been a hero than a villain doing something spectacular every other week, you know, rescuing people or something. But those opportunities were never really available. Actually, they were, in a sense, they were more available once I was committing my crimes, because I was out on the street all the time, driving around for days on end. You know, at nights, I was out every night like clockwork, driving around, so I spotted more things happening, you know.
So as a side hustle to his murdering gig, David Berkowitz, while driving around, kept his eyes peeled for opportunities to leap into action as a sort of homegrown superhero, just your average, everyday crime fighter.
He consciously looked for cases where he could get involved, and in one case probably saved an elderly security guard from being assaulted and possibly killed by a young gang of vandals.
David intervened in a crime currently in progress, at a Radio Shack, no less. And if you don't know what Radio Shack is, it was a chain of stores that sold parts for do-it-yourself home electronics projects. It doesn't exist anymore. Anyway, he saw a crime taking place there, and he stopped to help.
There was a store broken into by a bunch of youths, you know. It's a Radio Shack store on Dyer Avenue in Boston Road. I was riding along. That's Dyer Avenue in Boston Road. This is in the Bronx in New York City. I saw them smashing the plate glass window of a big Radio Shack store. So I pulled the car over to the side of the road. This is in a shopping plaza, but it's right off the main road. You can see the stores are like about 100 feet off, and there's a whole plaza, like a U-shaped thing. And I saw them back there, and then there's a guard in a booth at the front. So he grabbed his nightstick and started to run. And I said, well, this guy's going to be in trouble because these youths were like, you know, 16, 17 years old, or about 20 of them. And so I hopped out of my car, grabbed the police call box telephone there, and I called up the police, said there's a looting going on in the store, and then I hopped in my car, and I sped down there, just like my car looked like a police car, if you looked at it, you know, in a certain way, because it was a Ford Galaxy. And they saw me, and they all ran. When they ran, they took off, and they managed to grab a few of the receivers or whatever amplifiers that were in the window. They put them down and took off. And then the cops came, and I said, I just was passing through, but the guard, you know, was an old man, probably a retired guy working on the side. I says, you know, Mr. You're lucky you weren't killed. You should, the first thing you do when you see something like this, call the police. Don't you can't handle all these guys yourself. And he was cursing and all excited, you know. But then the cops came, and it was a routine thing. This is a high crime area over there. And that was it, you know. But I'm saying that the cops, even themselves, here I was, you know, they're looking all over the city for me, because this was around 1977. The cops, by then, were looking all over the city for me. And here I was talking with about six of them, about three cop cars pulled up. And I had the gun right in my pocket, you know.
With the city full of armed officers looking to take him into custody by any means necessary, David Berkowitz picked up the phone and called them directly. And he did it in order to save the life of an elderly security guard. Then, when it was over, he hung out with the police in the parking lot, all with the exact murder weapon they were all looking for sitting right there in his pocket.
He sounded an alarm. The police arrived and thanked him for being a responsible citizen by alerting them to a crime, potentially saving the life of a victim. And this was at the time that every cop in New York City was on alert and overtime looking for him. And he was standing there with, at this time, a mythological .44 caliber handgun in his jacket pocket, talking with the police who were searching for this serial killer who had terrorized the city and happened to be him.
Always happy to help, and with little regard for his own safety, no less.
This is why sometimes I try so hard to say to society, well, you know, I'm not a bad person, I'm not that bad, but it's impossible for them to know all this, so they can never see it. And sometimes it bothers me, but I realize there's nothing I can really, you know, do about it. They never know.
Maybe it's not impossible, maybe they will know about it.
Well, I don't think people really care, you know, because sometimes if people just want to love that demented, demon-possessed angle or something, or, you know, this is an unfortunate thing. Most people don't care to really learn what motivated me. That's why they don't help people in the street. They're not interested, you know. They got their own lives. They're looking out for number one. And these, again, these are the majority of the so-called law-abiding people.
No one will ever know what a good guy David Berkowitz actually is. He may be right about that. Jack asked David what he would do if he came across someone firing a gun into a parked car.
I asked him what if he had happened upon another character like himself, and he had a gun, and he could prevent someone from being killed. And he didn't hesitate. Oh, yeah, I would get out and I would hold that guy till the cops came, or I would kill him. I would save those innocent people. I mean, without blinking.
If you'd seen somebody going up to a car and shooting people,
I would have gone after him. I know damn well I was taking my gun and chased him. It would have been like a natural reaction without thought, you know, because this is the way I am. I immediately get involved in something. If I see an injustice being committed or somebody in danger, my immediate reaction is right to get involved and help, you know.
David said that if while out driving around on one of his little missions, he happened upon some maniac firing round after round into a parked car, that he, no question, would have stopped to help 100%. The bottom of this barrel of bonkers knows no end. Act 3, Virginia Voskarichian.
After the murder of Christine Freund and tremendous press coverage of that killing, he laid low for a while. By this time, the entire city was being terrorized and headlines and speculations daily. He laid low for about a month before he felt the need to go back and fill more blood and ink. He was looking for the kind of excitement that since childhood and his mother's incredibly emotional reaction to his grandfather's death had left him with, this death is something, a spectacle, people weeping and wailing, the ultimate shock. And when he saw that he was committing murders that resulted not only in immediate family members being rattled to the core, but an entire city being swept up in not just shock and fear, but many genuinely the lives of these young people who were being taken for no obvious reason. I think it was around that time he just needed to create the shock value that comes from murder and whatever psychosexual satisfaction that he got from that.
And so it was that on March 8, 1977, on an especially warm spring day, David Berkowitz, so disconnected from the world around him, put on a ski jacket and a brown stocking hat, then left the apartment. Once again, driving back to Queens. Quote, I picked Queens because there are a lot of pretty women there. It seemed to me that Forest Hills was where the prettiest ones were, end quote. After reaching his destination, the aforementioned upper-middle-class neighborhood of Forest Hills, he parked his car on Tennis Place, a street so named because it ran along the edge of the West Side Tennis Club and the Forest Hills Tennis Stadium. Then he got out and began wandering around the peaceful neighborhood comprised of mainly Tudor-style homes. As he did, he left the car unlocked, which was a new thing for him. Previously, when leaving the car to commit a murder, he locked the doors, just as any average citizen would. Now he left the doors unlocked, so that upon his return, he could get away quickly. David Berkowitz was, quite unfortunately, starting to use his head.
Okay, fifth crime.
That was also in Forest Hills, Queens, about 50 feet past the last one. It would be about 5 weeks later.
What were the casualties here?
One woman was killed. She wasn't sitting in a car, she was walking home. And I just shot her.
Same thing, you had seen her walking and you parked the car somewhere away and walked back? You drove by?
No, I was prowling that neighborhood. I was there for about an hour, just walking around. And I saw her, and I just did it to
her. How close to the patrol?
About a foot away. It's terrible when I think about it.
Did you walk behind her or in front of her?
In front of her.
You didn't really look at her?
No.
It was dark. I get the impression that you didn't really look at any of the people.
No, I didn't. If I'd have looked them in the face, I'd never,
David walked up to a young woman on the sidewalk and shot her in the face. It had all gone to his head. The press, the coverage, the growing hysteria. Now he had become, in his own mind, a nearly mythological villain, a status he could never achieve as a hero. He was now a bold and fearless killer. Here's our series producer, Allison Baker.
Yolanda and Garo Voskarichian waited almost a decade for their visa to come through. And when it did, they packed up their three children, Dekron, Alice, and Virginia, and moved from their home in Sofia, Bulgaria, to a new home in Queens, New York, USA. The Voskarichians were extremely tight-knit, and each member worked hard to contribute to the overall success of the family. Garo worked as a watchmaker back in Bulgaria, which quickly earned him a job at the luxury watch company Longines. Yolanda worked long hours as a housekeeper, and Alice helped out by working as a student teacher, while Dekron worked in an auto part shop nearby. The youngest, Virginia, now a naturalized American citizen, had just transferred to Columbia University's Barnard College from Queens College as a sophomore. Barnard had an excellent reputation for Russian studies, which was important to Virginia, being a longtime student of Russian literature. Virginia loved music and fashion, and despite being an honor student, she always made time to hang out with her friends. The Voskarichians lived in the affluent neighborhood of Forest Hills Gardens, a seemingly safe, privately owned neighborhood with rows of picturesque Tudor-style homes, and the commute to Barnard was easy, just two trains and a short walk to the house on Exeter Street. It was on a commute such as this, the evening of March 8, 1977, when Virginia had finished her classes and was heading home to Queens from the west side of Manhattan. Just before 7:30 p.m., Virginia exited the Continental Avenue subway station and began her 10-minute walk towards her house, books in hand. The streetlights appeared to be dimmer than usual. Recently, there had been a disagreement within the community regarding the cost of lighting, the result of which was the use of cheaper, dimmer bulbs that left the street poorly lit and hard to navigate. One of the streetlights along Dartmouth Street was out completely. As Virginia headed down this darkened street, a man in a ski jacket, unusual for this warm night, was walking towards her holding something. As the man passed, she could see it was a gun. When she looked into his eyes, he pointed it at her face. With no time to run, she quickly held her school textbooks and a 1977 calendar over her face to protect herself. He pulled the trigger. The bullet ripped through the books and into her skull. Virginia dropped to the ground. She was dead on impact.
Quote, "I raised my gun and shot her once. This took only seconds. But during that evening, I had passed dozens of potential victims. I don't know why I chose her. I could barely make out her facial features. However, I was on the street for several hours, just walking, thinking, and prowling. Now that I look back on this, none of this makes any sense." End quote. David describes the events leading up to the murder.
It was like a residential area, and the street was like about this wide, you know. So you have to just almost rub shoulders to pass, and I just, you know. People in New York City don't usually stare at each other. They just sort of like look down ahead and mind your own business and just go by about your business. And I guess they didn't, she didn't suspect anything.
She didn't, she wasn't, there wasn't a moment when she was aware that you got a gun in your hand.
Just a few seconds before that, but it was too late. You know?
You had experienced anything before?
Just briefly for a second. Because she showed an emotion, you know. The others didn't, because they didn't. If they did, it was afterwards, because the surprise element.
David said that Virginia Voskarichian, quote-unquote, showed an emotion in the moments before her death. And the idea I get is that that made David uncomfortable.
I think he was as terrified as his victim was at that time, because he talked about seeing the emotion that he tried to avoid in each one of the killings. He wanted them not to know that they were going to die, that he could commit the murder, spill the blood, walk away as guilt-free as possible.
David wasn't looking for a two-way interaction. He wanted to vent his anger and frustration by robbing someone of their life, but he didn't want to know or even acknowledge that his victims were real people at all, let alone that they had any feelings. Knowing that they did, confronting that, literally coming face to face with it, just ruined the whole thing for him. David explains.
To me, they were, at that time, as angry as I was feeling, I had reduced them to just objects of my anger, hatred, or whatever. And they were not there to show emotion. I didn't want to do them undue harm or torture them. You know, I just wanted to, well, you know. So I didn't want to just go up there and strike up a conversation, because then I could never do it. I had convinced myself in my own mind that they were deserving of this. Of course, I see that I had only deceived myself, you see. But at that time, I realized that these were just people that like somehow deserved this. And I was going to take out my wrath on them. But in order to do that, I could not let myself, if I would let myself or put myself in a position where I saw that they were really, you know, humans, and if I engaged them in conversation or something, then that would immediately, I would lose everything I psyched myself up for. I could never do that if I had seen them in, as people. I hope you understand what I'm saying, you know.
Throughout the attacks, we see David attempting to close the distance between himself and his victims, almost as if in his own twisted and depraved way he was attempting to approach, through murder, the people and feelings he was never able to approach in his day-to-day life. We see it first in the case of Michelle Foreman, his first attempt to take the life of a young woman, which he did with a hunting knife on Christmas Eve, 1975. We see it again three attacks later, on November 27th, 1976, in the case of Donna DeMasi and Joanne Lomino, where, after establishing the parked car's MO, he almost immediately breaks it by approaching the two young women on their porch, and after speaking to them, opens fire, cutting off their opportunity to respond. Then, of course, we see it here, for a third and final time, in the case of Virginia Voskarichian, where on March 8th, 1977, after reading, and perhaps believing, a little too much of his own press, walks up to the young woman and shoots her in the face, before sheepishly returning to the parked car MO for the rest of the attacks. With each break in MO, we see David stepping into close physical proximity, then quickly retracting, the emotions of the proximity proving to be too much for him to handle. David Berkowitz was much more comfortable firing into parked cars. Parked cars seemed to provide some sort of sweet spot for him, allowing him to approach his victims while maintaining his isolation, not to mention keeping him physically safe, and perhaps, most importantly, shielding him from any emotions those he targeted might have expressed. Of course, all this was buried under his given reason, that he imagined his unwanted conception between his birth mother, Betty Falco, and his birth father, Joseph Kleinman, had occurred in a parked car, where it most likely had not.
When you're in a car, you have to do something to get out. It would be very difficult for someone to respond quickly. And he tried to approach from the side or behind without being seen. He had this mental fixation, and maybe his biological mother had told him that he was conceived in a car during a moment of passion. But yeah, women and cars were a definite turn on to him in some ways as targets.
And yeah, as Jack says, he seemed to get some kind of thrill out of it. It would have been, after all, the height of his post-military sexual experiences, sneaking up on young women in parked cars in the middle of the night, then opening fire.
This would have been the closest he came to actually engaging in sexual activity, whether or not the gun was an extension of his sexual apparatus. And each discharge of that weapon was a substitute ejaculation of some kind. But there was no doubt an element of his own repressed sexuality in these crimes.
With the attack on Virginia Voskarichian, David Berkowitz had committed his third murder. In this, his fifth attack with the .44, his sixth attack overall. And so he had so far attacked a total of 10 people. After he viciously shot down Virginia Voskarichian at close range, David began walking back to the car. As he did, a 59-year-old civil engineer passed him on the sidewalk. As he passed, David looked up and said, "Hi, mister." This civil engineer would be the first person to see David Berkowitz leaving the scene of a crime, although he did not know it at the time. Shortly after this interaction, David started to run. A few minutes later, three plainclothes detectives assigned to an anti-crime task force saw a man frantically running down the street. Deeming the behavior suspicious, they pulled over to question him. This man was David Berkowitz. As they pulled the car over, an officer in the back seat started to get out to question David. Just then, a call came out over the police radio alerting the officers to a murder that had just occurred a few blocks away. Not considering, even for a second, that the man who stood before them could possibly be the murderer, the officers left David standing on the street, free to leave, his innocent looks once again shielding him from any suspicion. This little interaction between David and the police sort of summed up the investigation at this time, in that, essentially, the police had nothing. No description, no car, and no connection between any of the victims, either to each other or to the murderer, who detectives could only imagine was out there somewhere wandering within the 362 square miles and 8 million people of New York City. The only thing they did have was the gun, the Charter Arms Bulldog 44, literally the only thing that linked the crimes together. And so, if at any point Berkowitz would have tossed it, he most likely would have never been caught. To make matters even stranger, after David reached his car and drove away from the scene without issue, police dispatchers, having put out the distress signal code 44, had assigned two female officers to patrol the toll booth at the south end of the Bronx Whitestone Bridge, instructing them to stop any single male driver. As David approached the bridge, the loaded 44 was laying in full view on the seat next to him. When he pulled up to the bridge, he was astonished to see the officers shutting down their post for the night, deciding to quit just a few minutes early. David Berkowitz watched the officers walk back to their patrol car as he drove through the toll booth and onto the bridge. It was events like this that began to give David the idea that he was some sort of phantom that would never be caught, saying later, quote, "The police couldn't see me. I was an illusion," end quote. And in some ways, he was right. Before it was all over, there would be so many near misses that many of the citizens of New York City, and indeed the entire world, would feel the same way. After safely making it back to his apartment, David immediately turned on the TV. Quote, "After the shooting, I drove straight home and watched the news on the 11 o'clock news. The next day, I finished the Daily News, Post, and Times. I remember the headline, 'Second Killing Stuns Forest Hills,'" end quote.
He was encouraged by the media coverage at that point. He had to prove to himself that he was bolder than he actually is and confront his fear of killing someone at point-blank range and knowing that it wasn't just a target, that it wasn't his own twisted image of his mother, but it was an innocent, fearful young woman.
Back at the crime scene, Officer Borelli, who was tasked with putting an end to the senseless string of attacks, had this to say. Quote, "If you watch detectives at any homicide, you'll notice that they go about their jobs unemotionally. At this one, they didn't want to look at her. They knew it was senseless. She was someone beautiful, and she was laying under the sheet. A bullet in her face had destroyed her. It began to grab at them in the guts, and they just turned away. They were veterans, and they couldn't take it," end quote. Virginia's mom had this to say of her daughter, quote,
"When she was small, we would go outside. She'd just look at flowers. She would like them, love them, but never touch them. When I would reach to pick one, she would say, 'Mommy, let it live. I don't want to have a broken flower.'"
After the Voskarichian killing, Officer Borelli requested his task force be increased in size from 16 to 30 men. He immediately got what he asked for, and the task force was doubled. Good thing, too, because David's pattern was becoming more erratic and more complex with every attack, making that pattern, if you can call it that, much more difficult to sort out. In addition to consistently changing location, as well as flip-flopping MO, the Voskarichian murder also signaled a change in time, as it occurred much earlier in the evening than the other attacks. So early, in fact, that it occurred before any of the patrols tasked to search for the killer had even begun.
The Voskarichian murder occurred as an anomaly. It was outside his normal pattern of cruising late at night and looking for couples. Her murder took place a little earlier in the evening than most of them. And that again goes to the fact that he probably realized that late at night, men and women particularly, who might be tempted to go sit and make out in a car, were avoiding being on the streets. His ideal targets were beginning to disappear. And he had to risk going out earlier. And it just happened to be this wonderful, young, beautiful woman who was walking back from the library or someplace she had been studying and was immediately frightened, did what any normal human being would do, which is to put anything you might have in your hands by way of defense between you and the person that you see is clearly going to attack you in some way, and instinctively held up a book, hit her in the face, and killed her.
The murder of Virginia Voskarichian had a terrifying effect on the city. Now, it was not only dangerous to be out in the middle of the night, the window had been widened. Now you could get shot in the early evening. And it could happen virtually anywhere.
You can get shot if you're in a car with another man or woman, or talking to somebody else on the porch of your home, or walking alone. The only common factor at that point was the gun and the fact that the primary target seemed to be young, dark-haired women.
News of the .44 caliber killer filled the city with a level of fear pretty much unparalleled in the city's history. No one, least of all the police, had any idea how to behave or what to do next. Next time on Killer Tape. David continues his vicious attack on young women, and as he does, decides that if he isn't going to get caught, he's going to need a story.
When did you first take the name of Son of Sam?
Well, it just came to me, you know, because I've always had a wild imagination. And the idea of calling myself Son of Sam, I guess, just came to me. Maybe I read Son of Something in a book, but I'm not really cognizant of it. I don't really recall, you know. I just named it after Sam Carr, because Sam Carr was causing me a lot of aggravation with his dog barking. Now, let me take the dog wasn't talking, as I said, it was barking.
So this was more an elaborate metaphor.
Yes, that's what it is. It was very elaborate, but it was nothing.
Thanks for listening to Killer Tape, the true crime podcast where killers and hardcore criminals tell their own story in their own words. Killer Tape is written and produced by me, documentary filmmaker Bill Badgley, as well as veteran prison reporter Jack Jones. Additional writing and producing by Allison Baker. Executive producers include Jared Gutstadt, Jimmy Jelinek, and Phil Alberstadt. Research assistants by Olivia Pepper. Transcription services provided by Laura Klein Shaw. Editing and sound design by Molasses Manifesto Productions. Original score by Ben Von Wildenhaus. Artwork by Mike Gabriel. Killer Tape is based on 19 hours of audio recorded with David Berkowitz inside Attica Prison in March of 1980 by veteran prison reporter Jack Jones. Additional resources for the series include Confessions of Son of Sam by David Abrahamson, M.D. and Son of Sam by Lawrence D. Klausner. Special thanks to Christian Bernhardt and Shelby Shankman at UTA. Stay safe out there.